Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, some wise thoughts on capitalism, democracy, and ecology. It's looking like we can't have all three at once. We'll hear from Noam Chomsky, and also, if time permits, from Christian Sorensen. I hope you'll stay tuned. In the 1990s, all the media pundits were celebrating the triumph of neoliberal economic policy, deregulation, and capitalism in general. The Soviet Union had collapsed, communism had nearly vanished, socialism was in retreat, the United States was the world's sole great power, and neoliberal capitalism reigned supreme. The stock market was at a record high, corporate profits were at a record high, and pundit Francis Fukuyama was declaring the end of history. Utopia for one and all, apparently. The pundits failed to mention a couple of other facts. Working class wages were declining. Industrial jobs were disappearing rapidly, and wealth was being concentrated at the top of the economic pyramid. Democracy in America has always been fairly weak, but now democracy was rapidly getting even weaker. At the time, a few shrewd critics did note that not all was well. The corporations and the rich may have been enjoying a golden age, but the outlook for the rest of us did not look so rosy. Noam Chomsky was one of the dissenting voices, and Chris Hedges, and Neil Postman, and journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. But of course, none of the dissenters got the slightest amount of airplay in the corporate-controlled media. The great crash that began in 2007 didn't surprise anybody who was paying attention. What did surprise many of us was how rapidly and how thoroughly the federal government plundered the U.S. Treasury, then gave trillions of our dollars to the private banking corporations so the banks and their shareholders wouldn't lose a dime on the crash that they caused. Meanwhile, the government did practically nothing to help the millions of citizens who were getting crushed in the crash. If this were a democracy, would this have happened? Would the government take $1 trillion from the working citizens and simply give it to people who were already indefensibly rich? Incidentally, the head of the government during this unprecedented giveaway was a Democrat. That champion of the little guy, Barack H. Obama. Well, the situation has gotten worse since then. Now we are facing not just the destruction of the American middle class, but the destruction of the ecosphere. But the same people are calling the shots, and they're calling the same shots. And the score looks like it's capitalism 2, democracy 0. And who even knew that capitalism and democracy were opposing teams? Well, it's becoming more apparent that they are. Noam Chomsky discusses the connections between capitalism, democracy, and the fate of life on Earth. This is from his recent long talk in Cambridge, Mass. On April 24, 2017. You'll recognize the lady asking the questions as Amy Goodman. Here they are.
Which takes us to your latest book, Requiem for the American Dream, where you talk about the 10 principles of the concentration of power and wealth, how it's happening, what to watch out for.
Well, credit for the 10 principles should go to the producers of the film. What they did was take a lot of interviews and discussions about all sorts of things and put them in a coherent and, I think, pretty effective form. You can look at the film and see, or the book, but my feeling is they did a really good job.
So the book is accompanying this film that is now out on Netflix. But you talk about, for example, Principle 1, reducing democracy, Principle 2, shaping ideology, and Principle 3, redesigning the economy.
Well, all of those fall together, and they're part of a pretty remarkable development that's taking place in, actually, in human history. Humans, in the last 60 or 70 years, have succeeded in creating a kind of a perfect storm, literally. Two major attacks on the prospects for survival: global warming, nuclear weapons, the Anthropocene, the nuclear age. And the third is a set of socioeconomic policies designed to undermine the possibility of dealing with the problems. The problems could be dealt with only in a functioning democracy of engaged, informed people who could make decisions, who would be informed and could make decisions to deal with the crises. But the so-called neoliberal programs of the past generation, designed to undermine the institutions, the governmental and popular institutions that might deal with these issues, all a unit. One result is a very significant decline in democracy. You can't carry out economic policies of the type that have been implemented in the past generation in a functioning democracy. That's impossible. Let me just take a look at the numbers. The neoliberal programs were basically taking off right around 1980. It escalated, started a little with the late Carter, escalated under Reagan, went on more under Clinton, and so on. 2007 was the peak of supposed success. This is right before the crash. A lot of euphoria among economists, political analysts about the great achievements of neoclassical economics, of the great moderation, the neoliberal programs, dismantling of regulations, all these great successes. 2007, what was happening to American working people at that time? In 2007, wages, real wages, were lower than they had been in 1979 when the experiment took off. In fact, for the majority of the population, it's a period of stagnation or decline. Benefits have declined. Some of the reasons were explained by Alan Greenspan, head of the Federal Reserve, who was in charge pretty much of managing the economy. He testified to Congress that part of the success of the economy, the low inflation and so on, was due to what he called growing worker insecurity. Working people were insecure. They were intimidated. They knew that they were in a dangerous situation, precarious situation. As a result, they didn't press for increase in wages and for decent wages and benefits. They were willing to accept effective decline in their living standards. And Greenspan, who was a close observer of the economy, pointed out that this continued even when jobs were increasing in the late Clinton period. It was deeply embedded in the nature of the policies being carried out that working people are intimidated, they're living precarious lives, many of them are part-time, they're losing security, their unions are being destroyed, and their wages are declining. So it's all great. The economy is wonderfully healthy. Can you carry out policies like that in a democracy? I mean, are people going to vote for it? Same in Europe, even worse in many ways. The so-called austerity programs, even the economists of the international, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, their own economists report that these policies make no economic sense. But the IMF bureaucrats, the ones who are part of the decision-making apparatus, they vote for them. And the effect on Europe is the same thing. As far as democracy is concerned, just like in the United States, there's anger, contempt for, you know, for the major governing institutions. Here it's Congress, there it's the political parties. You just saw it in France yesterday. The two major parties were barely visible in the election, and it's happening all over Europe, same kind of thing that's happening here. I mean, here it's happening in a way which is almost farcical because of the kind of actions carried out by the leadership. In Europe, it's being pursued in a way which is really ominous. I mean, you don't have to look far back to find a time when fascist parties actually had power in Europe, and we know what happened. And now there are neo-fascist parties with fascist roots often, which are pretty close to power, even in places like Austria and Germany, which have some memories of it. France as well was a very pro-Nazi country. The Vichy government was rounding up Jews faster than the Germans wanted them. A really ugly record. And seeing these things come back, or just seeing a situation in which, according to recent polls, a majority of Europeans think there should be no more Muslims in Europe. I mean, that evokes some memories, not nice ones. You can't attribute it all to the neoliberal economic policies, but a lot of it does follow from that. When you impose on people circumstances of this kind, you have to make sure that they have no way of responding politically. In Europe, it's done pretty straightforwardly. The main decisions about socioeconomic policies are made by the so-called Troika, IMF, European Central Bank, and the European Commission, which is unelected. So three unelected bodies, they make the decisions. They do listen to voices, the voices of the northern banks, mostly German banks, and the people suffer. And they get they're angry, frightened, often reacting in dangerous ways. We see similar phenomena here. So to go back to the pincers movement, what's happened is we've created two huge threats to survival. We have systematically, not you and me, but the leadership has systematically created socioeconomic policies which have as a consequence, almost immediate consequence, the undermining of functioning democracy, the one thing that might deal with the disasters. Like I said, it's kind of perfect storm. Real credit to the human species to have contrived something like this.
Principle 4 is shift the burden onto the poor and the middle classes. Principle 5, attack the solidarity of the people. 6, let special interests run the regulators. 7, engineer election results. 8, use fear and power of the state to keep the rabble in line.
Is it necessary to comment? I think you're all familiar with it.
9 is manufacture consent, and principle 10 is marginalize the population.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what's happening. And there's a reason for it. You cannot carry out the kinds of policies that have been developed in the last generation and have the population function democratically. In Europe, you can't get people to vote for policies which are undermining their lives, which are leaving especially younger people without any hopes of decent employment, which are driving people to precarious existences, which are undermining wages, reducing benefits. In England, right now, undermining, threatening what had been the world's most effective and efficient national health system. You can't get people to vote for things like this. So what you have to do is marginalize them in one way or another, turn them against each other, turn their anger against vulnerable people. That's a standard technique. Don't look at the people who are really doing this to you. Look at the ones who are more vulnerable. Immigrants, the poor, you know, Muslims, blacks, anybody. We're familiar with that, too. There's not a slight history about it. It's like an almost logical consequence of the socioeconomic policies which have been imposed and lauded, in fact, by elites, including liberal elites. You know, a lot of this was done, let's say, by the Clinton administration. That's what was held. The deregulation, for example, which very quickly led to one after another financial crisis, that was initiated by liberal economists who were telling us how wonderful it is. And there's actually a theory, a neoclassical economic theory, which says, yeah, it's fine. Actually, there were people who warned against it. There were people who knew a lot of left independent economists, but even people right out of the mainstream, like Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, back around 1995 or so, he wrote an article actually in a World Bank research journal in which he warned against what he called the religion that the market knows best. He says, that's the religion, as he put it, that's being followed by economists. And he says, you got to take a look at that religion. It, like a lot of religions, it just doesn't work. Economic history and even logic show us lots of things that are wrong about it, but that was pursued with abandon on the basis of theories of efficient markets, rational behavior, rational expectations, and so on, none of which had any empirical basis or founding. The doctrines were accepted for the very simple reason that they were highly beneficial to wealth and power. And that makes them acceptable, and you get the results that you have. The undermining of the only means possible to try to deal with the existential crises that we have created. So again, it's a kind of perfect storm. Part all sorts of sources, including just socioeconomic policies of a bipartisan nature.
You talk about a perfect storm. Do you think fascism is rising in the United States?
I think there's a danger of fascism in Europe. You have to be a little bit careful about that. I mean, if you're a black kid in the ghetto, yeah, you can say it kind of looks like fascism. But for most of us, people like us, there aren't stormtroopers in the streets. There's no fascist political party. There's no ideology of fascism. The Trump ideology reduces to pretty much me, you know. That's not fascism, whatever you think it is. So there are serious dangers. But I think fascism, in a way, gives it too much credit. It makes it look like more of a well-formulated ideology than it actually is. I think what we're seeing are the desperate efforts to try to hold together rising disasters that for which the means have been undermined.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pyjamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira. Now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. Quite as wonderful as money.
Money.
There is nothing like a newly minted pound.
Money.
Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that wakes the world around. You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phase. For it's money, money, money makes the world go round.
A little socioeconomic political commentary by Monty Python. And before that, one of America's finest thinkers on matters of current events and national policies, Professor Noam Chomsky. He is Professor Emeritus at MIT Department of Linguistics. Humorist Richard Armour, himself a Professor Emeritus, reminds us that emeritus means out of merit. Well, I think that Chomsky is not quite out yet. He still has considerable merit. Chomsky explained the perfect storm created by our capitalist economic system. The storm consists of 1. Global climate change, 2. Nuclear weapons, and 3. the undermining of democratic institutions that could deal with problems 1 and 2. For that lucid analysis, thank you again, Professor Emeritus Chomsky. Maybe I should explain. Professor Emeritus is an honorary title given to tenured college professors when they retire. Tenured professors are now a dying breed. Like other capitalist greedheads, university administrators prefer to hire low-wage, insecure, part-time contingent workers, hired semester to semester, to do as much of the teaching as possible. This is one of the great scandals of even our great universities. These contingent faculty are called part-time adjunct instructors. So far, there has been no part-time adjunct instructor emeritus, possibly because part-time adjunct instructors can never afford to retire. Usually, they're not eligible for a pension plan or any other benefit in any case. Welcome to the gig economy, my fellow PhDs. But I digress. Or do I? Enough of me. Let's hear from Christian Sorensen. His article was published at counterpunch.org on March 28, 2017. Sorensen does not talk about democracy, but, like Chomsky, he does focus on capitalism and its destruction of our environment. It's titled, We've Let Capitalism Kill the Planet, by Christian Sorensen. Here goes. The headlines in the first 3 months of 2017 have made one thing clear. Capitalism is killing the planet. Capitalism, the governing structure of nearly every society on Earth, puts profit above all other considerations. The consumer cycle is indifferent to proper disposal or reprocessing of discarded natural resources because such actions do not maximize profit. Oceans suffer greatly. They cover over 70% of the Earth's surface. They are integral to the prosperity of all known life. Human-caused climate change is killing fish stocks and fundamentally changing marine ecosystems. Human activity is depleting oxygen in the oceans. Plastics are everywhere. Humans root roughly 150 million tons of plastic into the oceans each year. Microplastics from the likes of synthetic fabrics and vehicle tires choke ocean life. Approximately 46,000 pieces of discarded plastic of various sizes occupy any square mile of ocean. They work their way up the food chain. Extinctions are commonplace. Critical areas of land, including wetlands and forests, are vanishing at astonishing rates. Earth has lost roughly 10% of her wilderness since the 1990s. Humans threaten over 60% of the world's primates with extinction. Harsh agricultural practices, tourism, and construction are rapidly killing grasshoppers across Europe. And grasshoppers are a critical food source for many animals, including reptiles and birds. The middle class is going extinct as well. The world's richest 8 humans have as much money as the poorest half of the world's population. The richest 1% of the entire human population possesses as much wealth as the rest of humanity. These examples are just a drop in the bucket. These are not anomalies. Pollution is the capitalist routine. Pollution is profit. Raising forest for profit is humdrum. Extinction is progress. Asphyxiating Earth is good for big business. Capitalism, the maximization of profit at the expense of animal and planet, is a plague of our own creation. The planet will eventually recover after humanity is gone, or once humanity collectively agrees to prioritize the health of our only home. Humans are ill, and capitalism is our collective infection. It must end. That was Christian Sorensen. We've let capitalism kill the planet. I edited the text just a little bit for clarity over the radio. Thanks to Sorensen and to Counterpunch.org. And thanks again to Chuck Rosina for the Chomsky recording. Thanks also to the several non-profit community radio stations that broadcast New World Notes. For example, stations KPHD and KGIG-FM in Modesto, California, ably managed by Mr. Brad at Valley Media. Not to mention that beacon of light in darkest Idaho, KRFP-FM, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. And closer to home, of course, WWUH-FM in West Hartford, Connecticut, coming out of the University of Hartford. And several other stations, too. Thank you. And, of course, thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find more of us at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, wishing you a good week, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Catch you later.